Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. I'm Seth Powell, and this is episode 18. Today's episode, we'll be speaking with Jacqueline Hargreaves, who listeners may know from The Luminescent. Jackie is, among many things, an independent yoga researcher, and she's also the partner of Jason Birch. And she's really just at the cutting edge of this recent tidal wave of yoga research. But as you'll hear, she's not a traditional academic. She doesn't hold a PhD. She comes from an engineering and yoga teacher background. And I think in this way, Jackie has a really unique perspective on the field. So it was really great to sit down with her for this wide-ranging conversation about her journey into yoga and Buddhist meditation, the research and many projects that she's been engaged with over the years and currently, and some of the real surprises and gems that have emerged through her and Jason's fieldwork in India and also in some really unexpected places. Be sure to stick around until the end of the episode because there's some great stories that Jackie unveils, including having tea with the Queen of Mysore, the Maharani herself. Now, Jason Birch and Jacqueline Hargreaves will be co-teaching a new online course for us here at Yogic Studies entitled YS114, Raja Yoga, History, Theory, and Practice. The course runs live from February 8th through March 5th, 2021. This course draws on their decades of research into the primary Sanskrit sources of Hatha and Raja Yoga. And I'm really just thrilled to have them share this course offering with our community. One of the unique features of this course, in addition to the primary sources and unpublished materials that we're going to be able to have access to, new translations by Jason Birch, as we discuss in this episode, one thing that's also going to be included is what Jason and Jackie call embodied philology. That is bringing the text to life through practical application. Jackie will be offering two practice sessions in this course, bringing the teachings of Raja Yoga to life. To learn more or to sign up for the course, you can go to yogicstudies.com/YS-114. Likewise, if you want to learn more about the incredible research and the story of Jason Birch, go back and check out episode 9 of the Yogic Studies podcast where I had Jason on. All right. Jacqueline Hargreaves is an engineer, senior yoga teacher, and independent researcher who examines the contemporary meeting place between historical yoga practices and their application in the modern world. She's a founding member of the Journal of Yoga Studies, a peer-reviewed academic journal, and the co-founder of The Luminescent, an independent, open-access educational platform for publishing cutting-edge, original research from primary sources. She's traveled throughout India for fieldwork into the origins of Hatha Yoga and studied meditation extensively, including mindfulness-based meditation and intensive Zen practice in a remote part of Japan. Hargreaves collaborates with scholars, artists, and scientists to communicate research on both pre-modern and modern facets of yoga. Most recently, she curated the exhibition Embodied Liberation at the Brunei Gallery in London for the Hatha Yoga Project at SOAS, the University of London, and in collaboration with the Ayur-Yoga Project, University of Vienna, Jacqueline curated the Untangling Tradition series and designed a web-based visual and interactive timeline for pre-modern yoga and Ayurveda. Hargreaves is currently producing a much-anticipated documentary film, which we'll talk about toward the end of this episode, which aims to bring life to the unique content of the postural practice preserved in an 18th century Sanskrit yoga text called the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati. Through a visual reconstruction of its extraordinary section on asana. And again, we'll talk about the making of the film and its journey and possible release dates towards the end of this episode. All right, so without further ado, please join me in welcoming Jacqueline Hargreaves. here today joined by Jacqueline Hargreaves. Jackie, welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for the invitation. It's an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. So how are things going? Where are you right now in the world? I know you guys have been moving around a bit.
Yes, we're natural nomads, renunciates who travel the world quite freely without a base. And at the moment, I'm tuning in to you from a place called Koola. Koola is a regional town in New South Wales, Australia. It's, a place where farmers usually live, and my sister happens to be an organic farmer. She's been living here for about 25 years, so we've come to visit her during our stay in Australia.
Wow. That sounds very, very idyllic, picturesque, although I know how difficult farm life is. But there in Australia, seems like in terms of the pandemic and COVID overall, although there's some exceptions, and you were telling me before about a recent outbreak, but overall they've done a really good job, it seems, of controlling it. So you've had a bit more freedom on that side to move around a bit in Australia?
Yes.
Are people walking around without masks
in
that area?
Yes, we're absolutely COVID-free, which is extraordinary given the circumstances around the world, and particularly coming from the UK, where the situation is quite dire, probably similar to that of the USA at the moment, whereas Australia has been able to manage the pandemic by closing its borders completely, which is one of the extraordinary things, I guess, is Australia is an island and it's always had quite rigid control over its borders. And we're benefiting from that, I guess, in terms of the pandemic. We've been able to keep through quarantine the COVID outbreaks at bay, and particularly in regional Australia, there's been absolutely no cases whatsoever, so we're free to move about, we're free to meet with people, and we feel quite safe that way. It is one lucky thing, I guess, about being in a country which has been able to control the pandemic.
Mm. Wow. Well, that's it's very inspiring, looking out from California and the current state of things here, which is really heading in the opposite direction, it seems. So I'm glad you guys were able to make it there. I know previously you'd been living in the UK, Jason has been working on the Hatha Yoga project, and so needing to be close to SOAS, the University of London. But you guys have also, as you said, been yoga nomads of sorts, traveling all over the world. So I'm curious to hear about some of those experiences today. I'm excited to talk to you about your own independent yoga research that you've been doing, the work that you've been doing for The Luminescent, the Journal of Yoga Studies, the Embodied Liberation Art Exhibition. So many wonderful endeavors that you've had your hands in these last few years, especially. And then we're really excited to have you on board for this upcoming Raja Yoga course with Jason Birch. We'll talk more about it, I think, towards the end of the episode today. But I'm excited. This is our first course where we're having co-teachers. We previously did an episode with Jason. We encourage folks to go back and listen to that. But it's really great to get to have you on, Jackie, and to learn a little bit about your story and some of the work that you've been doing in the field of yoga studies. So to kick us off, maybe tell us maybe a brief version of your story of how you came to yoga and kind of how you came to doing research in this field.
Well, thank you, Seth, for the invitation once again. And it's an absolute pleasure to contribute to your platform, your growing platform, which really is a valuable resource and extending the knowledge of students in the field, which we greatly appreciate. In terms of my personal story with yoga, it's a rather long one in years, I guess. I was given an opportunity to study meditation from a very young age, I guess, in some ways, at school. I happened to go to a religious school in which they taught world religions, and I had some inspiring religious teachers who took it on board to share with us different aspects of meditation. And in some cases, we took on board practices such as lying down meditations and so forth as a means of addressing the stresses of school life, so studying and so forth. So for me, that was really one of my first exposures to that type of thing. And that's in the 80s, so during my high school.
Was that in Australia?
Yeah, Jackie? Yes, that was in Australia, yeah.
And that sounds like a very unique education.
Yeah, yeah.
Was it? You said it was a religious school.
Yes.
Was it a Christian-based education?
That's right. So it was a Catholic school, an all-girls Catholic school. And it just so happened we had two different, well, I happened to have two different religious teachers, both male, actually, and one of them had been a monk at one point, but he'd given up his pursuit or vocation, and another fellow who both were quite innovative in their teaching methods, I guess. So we looked at world religions, and we also took on board some practices during our school life, I guess, and it was mainly to do with dealing with the stresses of study, you know, because there was a lot of pressure on us as students to do well at school, even though we were, again, I wasn't in the heart of Sydney or something. I was in, you know, suburban Sydney studying at a Catholic school, which, you know, the opportunities to go to university and so forth were not given to, for example, my sisters who were all older than myself. They went to schools where it wasn't even possible to do what's called high school certificate, which would enable you to go to university. So for me, I feel quite privileged in that I was able to go to a school which enabled that to happen. So sometimes it's taken for granted, I guess, education and our access to education, but it really does form the basis of what opportunities are given to you in the future. And that's some of the driving force behind my efforts to offer sort of open access education to people on the subject of yoga, because really, you know, we don't realize how privileged we are sometimes with our ability to gain access to high quality education.
Yeah, that's right. And so I know from your bio, you went on to become an engineer. What came first for you, the yoga or the engineer training?
Well, the engineering I pursued, I guess, as my education at university. I went on to become an engineer working in IT and operational research. So I looked mainly at methods as well as systems design that supported the technology booms, I guess, of the 90s, which is the whole dot-com boom and that type of thing that went across the world. And what was interesting, I guess, for me was I have a very sort of mathematical scientific background, and it's one of my loves. But at the same time, one of my last projects as an engineer was based in India, and I was living there for a couple of years. This is in the mid-90s through to the late 1998, I think. I was living in Mumbai, working with Jet Airways, so it was a new airline at that time, and we were setting up what people know now as sort of call centres in India, but this is back in the days when these sorts of things weren't so common, and we were laying, you know, fibre optic cables from the airport at Mumbai through to, you know, offices where young women were sitting at benches getting trained up to be people who would answer phone calls. So this is really my first exposure, I guess, to life in India, was that of an engineer rather than as a yoga teacher or a hippie on the hippie trail. It was very much about going to India as a as an engineer and working in operational research. So this is where we designed systems, computer systems that supported airlines. So, you know, a lot of my work immediately after I left university was about servicing Southeast Asia with the technologies as airlines to function, right? So the load and balance of an aircraft, reward systems so that people can build up loyalty to their brand, you know, air crew balancing, so servicing where the crew were across the network, the worldwide network, so that they could not break the rules of flying too many hours in the right type of aircraft and keeping their qualifications up, which is something I find interesting about the pandemic at the moment, which is to notice that pilots aren't flying, and so there's some rules that will that govern how they can fly, where they can land, who they fly with, and so forth, or what type of aircraft and what airports they can land in. So all of this type of thing, I was very deeply involved in that type of research.
So when you're flying on a plane, Jackie, you must have a lot going through your mind.
Oh, I love it, you know. I do love it. You know, I feel very lucky that I had an opportunity to work in the that field, because it's one of my great passions, I guess. Flying is still something I enjoy very much. But anyway, my exposure, I guess, to yoga, it's a bit of a long story that way, was that I found within engineering, my pursuit of that, there was something lacking. You know, I just sort of looked around at the people who were, you know, in my field, and the sort of issues that they dealt with and the aspirations that they had. And I found myself longing for something more. And maybe this comes from having a religious education, that what are we striving for, and what are we, you know, what purpose are we living for? What sort of, what are we doing? What are we building with our hours of work and so forth? And so for me, that really did drive me to reflect on giving my life, I guess, to the pursuit of technology. And I felt, you know, I was one of the kind of one of the few people, I guess, back in the early 90s who was living what people feel they're living now, which is, you know, there's no barrier between your life at home and your life through technologies 24/7, because I was based in Australia, Sydney. My clients were in Southeast Asia, including India, but my company was in America. So I was working like a 24/7 time zone. And in IT at that time, you know, I was one of the first people using the internet to transfer files and talk to people and do all of this. And I realized that those boundaries create, without those boundaries, it was quite stressful, right? And it was very difficult to manage that type of work life. And I found myself thinking I wanted to pull away from that and look for something else. And it was funnily enough when I was in India that one of the head of the IT department there suggested that I look into yoga and go to Goa or something like that. And I was like, oh, I'm not interested in that at the time. But yes, it was my pursuit of really meditation and yoga back in Australia that I took that up more seriously.
So at some point you decided to give this yoga thing a try.
Yes, it was interesting. I guess in terms of yoga, physical yoga, I started to do quite seriously some Ashtanga yoga with a place called Yoga Moves. Some people will know that in Sydney. It just happened to be near where I lived. But my lifestyle at the time didn't allow me to regularly attend classes because I was constantly having to travel for work. And so I started more reading on my own, particularly that works of on yoga, but more specifically on meditation. And I became much more interested in Buddhist meditation and also the pursuit of understanding what the Buddha thought, which was one of my questions. I realized that there was a lot of secondary literature out there, and it was very difficult to get something that was close to you know, what was actually going on for that person way back in time, and what did they really think, and what is this practice? And so it led me down the path of pursuing sort of retreats and personal private retreats, I guess, going through a Thai Buddhist monastery that happened to be in New South Wales, in Bundanoon, and doing sort of longer style retreats on my own for meditation. But then I also realized that I needed some sort of physical support for that, and that's where my interest in Hatha yoga blossomed. But, you know, in the beginning, I would say I was much more, and still am, much more interested in these ideas of deep states of meditation. And it led me to take 6 months leave from work and pursue meditation in Japan. I thought I was going to leave and become a monk or a nun, if you like, in a Japanese Zen tradition. And so I lived in rural Japan and for a year, and lived a very, very simple life. And, it kind of suited me in some ways. It suited me a lot. And I went from having 6 months leave without pay from my job as an engineer to having a 1 year leave without pay. And that was a real formative phase, I guess, of my pursuit of more seriously the practices of meditation and yoga. And when I returned to Australia after that 1 year, I decided I couldn't go back to engineering, and I pursued, the practices of yoga and meditation full time. Mm.
It's always struck me as interesting. You know, I think myself, like you, before I got more serious about physical yoga, the practice of asana, I was more interested in meditation and exploring kind of the inner landscape of the mind and various traditions of meditation. And so I was inevitably led to Buddhism and more Buddhist traditions. I did Vipassana retreats, all kinds of meditation retreats, really. And looking back, it's sort of interesting. And looking around today, still in the modern landscape of yoga, so much of yoga is based around posture. And for students who want kind of more classical, if you will, teachings on meditation, they often do end up going to Buddhism, right? Which is like championed the practice of meditation. And yet, when we look at the history of yoga and Sanskrit yoga texts, we look at the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali, right? Which is supposedly like the Bible, if you will, of modern yoga. It is a text about meditation, but yet, like in terms of the modern schools of yoga, it's harder to find those teachings, and so people do end up going elsewhere. Do you have any thoughts about that? And maybe something I wanted to ask you. I think we've talked about this before, but just thinking about some of the similarities and differences between, you know, what it's today kind of called a mindfulness meditation or mindfulness-based meditation, and some of the similarities and differences between that and, say, postural yoga.
Yes, it's a good, very good point, Seth. And I think it's what we see with Buddhist meditations and the cultural expressions of Buddhism around the world is that they really are geared to supporting practitioner who wants to pursue meditation wholeheartedly. And this is one of the great religious traditions, really, that has enabled meditation to really come to the fore around the world as a practice. And so when people are looking to pursue meditation seriously, it is often that they move to Buddhism to do that. As you say, there's different ways of accessing that, whether it be through Vipassana, where you get to do your 14 days or 10 days, and it's really cost effective because often they're often offered fairly free or for a small dana, a small amount of offering. And when we look at and we contrast that with the traditions of yoga that have made that transnational leap through to Western culture, it's interesting because when we look very early, I guess, at some of the places where yoga was brought to Europe, there was certainly an interest in meditation traditions, Raja Yoga in particular, and it seems that it's got a little mixed up perhaps with the pursuit of physical dexterity as well as health and well-being, that yoga now is seen exclusively as that practices or those practices which are physically oriented and oriented towards the pursuit of dexterity of the body, if you like. And for me, I see them as completely complementary. That was why actually I became very interested in Hatha Yoga. It was my journey from Buddhist meditation to Hatha Yoga was that I realized that you do need health. And I happen to have a wonderful Japanese meditation teacher. He's living in Australia actually, and he was a extraordinary man because he not only did he offer meditation retreats, but he saw the value of physical practices. And in his own right, he had his own postural practice. It wasn't Indian yoga, but it was some sort of physical movements and also walking meditation and so forth. And so this idea that meditation is enhanced through the practice of physical movement and practices is not exclusively Hatha Yoga, but I realized that there were techniques within the Hatha Yoga repertoire which are really quite extraordinary. You know, they looked at ways in which you can manipulate the physiology of the body to bring about deeper states of meditation. And this, I think, is why I've, found it such a helpful and interesting historical thing to research, really. When we contrast it against something like mindfulness-based meditation, which has made the leap from a religious environment or a Buddhist environment to a secular therapeutic environment, often they have to complement it with some sort of movement. So you might do some mindful movements or awareness of the breath or awareness of your body when moving. But I do feel that there's technologies within Hatha Yoga which support it, and they're much more sophisticated, if you like. Whereas if you're looking for the technologies of meditation, then Buddhism is definitely the place to go, because it's just been pursued so thoroughly by so many people over so many centuries and across different cultures. So there is certainly a lot to learn from the pursuit of meditation within the Buddhist tradition.
Yeah, certainly. I think so much more to explore there. And in terms of scholarship, there's been no shortage of kind of new studies looking at the parallels between yoga and Buddhism. So we know how important those intersections are historically, but I think that continue. So going kind of continuing with your story, you started to now get more serious about yoga and meditation, renouncing your engineer lifestyle. Move us forward, connecting the dots between that early kind of exploratory time in your life and kind of getting serious about your practice and training. And then how do we get to kind of the work that you're doing today with the Luminescent and elsewhere? At some point, I know you meet Jason, and I'm sure your life kind of changed in certain ways through that meeting. So kind of maybe connect the dots for us a little bit, if you would.
I guess I was quite a serious practitioner coming out of my life in Japan, and then also the pursuit of Hatha Yoga. But I guess it was giving up that profession as an engineer and deciding that I was going to pursue yoga full-time, whatever form that took. I didn't have any real intentions of being a yoga teacher, which I know a lot of people do aspire to, but nonetheless, that's something that I have certainly given many years to since then. I guess I was lucky enough. Again, it's almost serendipitous sometimes when you decide to give one thing up and then you look in turn the other direction and something appears. And in this case, there was a school in Sydney called Samadhi Yoga. Many of my friends and I trained there together. And it was a real eclectic mix of traditions that they were offering in terms of yoga practices and techniques. And I found it a really vibrant and wonderfully supportive community to pursue all the different styles of yoga which were coming out of India at the time, including things like Kundalini yoga, Ashtanga yoga, variations of Hatha yoga, also devotional forms of Kirtan and so forth. So it was a very eclectic mix. But as well, there was a real passion and interest for the I don't like to say higher pursuits of meditation, but also just recognizing that these physical technologies are designed to lead to samadhi. You know, they're designed to lead to some sort of moksha or liberation or realization, right? So a technology of the body or a physiology practice that leads to some sort of transformation of mind. And you know, this is actually where I met Jason. He happened to be there as a contributor to the teacher training program. I became one of the coordinators of the teacher training program there, and he was coming in and teaching Sanskrit to yoga teachers and also pranayama. And pranayama was one of my interests because I had not really understood the breath or the power of the breath, mainly because I suffered quite a lot from allergies. From a personal perspective, I had difficulties with breathing. And it was one of the changes, I guess, for my own practice, moving from a Buddhist meditation idea, is when one looks closely enough during meditation and your object of meditation perhaps is the breath, if you have challenges with your breathing, sometimes this can be a source of anxiety, or it can be a source of, constant difficulty, because that's the area in which your health is challenged, I guess. And so for me, the pursuit of pranayama was of interest, and this was also one of Jason's passions, and we ended up through a mutual friend who was another yoga teacher, we ended up meeting socially, and that's where we sort of hit it off, really. And it was not long after that that we pursued a meditation retreat on our own, like a 2-month deep retreat where we designed, 8 to 10 hours of meditation a day, supported by, the techniques of Hatha yoga, pranayama, physical postures, chanting, and we did this.
Just the two of you?
Yeah, just the two of us in a remote part of Australia.
That's very romantic.
Very romantic start, yeah.
Yogi couple.
Yeah, and it was after that, immediately after that, we actually took a group of students from Australia to India to the Himalayas, and we did a retreat there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, we did. We took them. Took them up and pursued quite a rigorous schedule of practice, and it was since then that we've never really gone back to Australia. We didn't mean to leave, actually, but we sort of didn't get back. We stopped in Singapore, and we had a colleague there who's a very learned yoga teacher, Vivian, and we took some time in Singapore. She invited us to teach, and also Jason covered some of her classes, and we ended up staying in Singapore for a year and a half. And then, long story short, during that time, Jason was making applications to around the world to get some sort of funding for his PhD studies. And that was when we ended up in Oxford. So, the success of his scholarship there, receiving the Clarendon Fund, enabled us to travel to the UK. And in between all of that, we've been back and forth to India, really pursuing field work and the search of manuscripts, where I guess that fits in a lot with your work for philological research, Seth. And you know, I guess that was one of the things we also had in common. I was always interested in sort of trying to understand from a historical perspective some of these technologies, but I'm certainly not coming at it from a philologist's point of view. I'm coming at it from one who has pursued the practice quite quite seriously. And so that was where the fun began. We continued that type of research, traveling around India, looking for obscure texts on yoga and, you know, what might inform our personal practices, really. And it was in, you know, from 2008 to 2012 or something like that. You know, Jason was based in Oxford. We did quite a few fieldwork trips to India at that time, but I was also keeping up my teaching in Asia. So I was visiting Japan and Singapore and so forth, and continuing to teach yoga at that time to give us some sort of supplementary income and also to keep up my friendships and relationships with those in Asia.
Wow. Well, I didn't realize, I mean, there's really quite a number of parallels with my own story there, in that, you know, I also met my wife, Charlotte, at the yoga studio. We began, you know, going to India, traveling Asia together, studying yoga and meditation. We ended up leading a group also to the foothills of the Himalayas, a very intensive schedule of yoga and meditation. During that time, I was applying to grad school as well, and sort of the rest is history. Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the manuscript research. Honestly, just to mention, you know, here, since you bring that up, I mean, it really is very much in the work that I'm doing, and my dissertation work is so inspired by the work that Jason has done. It's been very, very inspiring. Now, you mentioned that in some ways you bring a little bit of a different perspective. You're not the traditional academic in that you haven't gone through the PhD program. You're coming at this more as a yoga teacher, as a practitioner. But yet, over the years, you've been right there at the table of these really heady Sanskrit philology workshops, all of these conferences. You're really right there on the front lines of this critical yoga research. What are those experiences like for you as somebody who's doing your own independent research, sort of an outsider looking in, but also an insider with your own unique contributions, and also viewing it kind of a little bit more as somebody who's within the, who identifies more, let's say, on the practitioner or the teacher side?
Yes, it's been an extraordinary opportunity, really, Seth, like, to meet some of the heavyweights of philology, really. And, you know, I have always read quite widely, and, you know, we were, Jason and I, before we had gone to the UK, for example, were well versed on the works of you know, Alexis Sanderson, Jim Mallinson, you know, David White at the time, who was quite big in the scene in the 90s and so forth, and Elizabeth de Michelis, we happened to meet her also. She happened to be in Oxford at the same time. So we were sort of quite well-versed on the material. And myself, I certainly don't see myself as a Sanskritist, mainly because, yes, I am interested in the history, but how does, given that I'm living in a contemporary time, and my pursuit of these practices is one of a living practitioner. And so when I look at this material, I certainly appreciate the skills and the dedication and the extraordinary efforts that scholars put into bringing to light this material. It certainly helped that way. I've certainly been involved for many, many years on that front, particularly, you know, the hard work of coming across the material. Like, people, once you see it as an edited edition, it really does hide a lot of the work that goes behind the scenes. And you would know that yourself, discussing, you know, right down to, you know, particular words and phrases and how they're interpreted within the context of that particular time period. You know, I guess as a generalist, if you're going to be a yoga teacher, you can very much just live in the world of reading a printed edition and not have to worry about the translation that's in front of you. But I've always been more interested in where these words come from and who spoke them and what were they thinking at the time. So those sorts of questions I keep asking myself, even when I'm sitting at a yoga conference with some of the world leading scholars in philology and Sanskrit. And it also brings to mind how much of it is so uncertain, because when you're in those environments, you realize that, you know, we've traveled across India, we've discovered these manuscripts, and sometimes the obscurity or the challenges of reading a particular script, or, you know, maybe there's a wormhole exactly where you need to find who the author is and what they thought, and all of these chance opportunities to look at an object that's come from the past and has documented somebody's words, and you realize what the role of a translator is. You know, they're piecing together these fragments, and a lot of it is up for debate, and based on your skillfulness of not only reading a diverse range of scripts, but also bringing together what might be the closest rendering of that text in a particular time period, and what did that author think at that time. So for me, this is quite an interesting aspect of, if you're going to look at the past and it's going to inform your practice in the future, well, I don't know, I see that the ambiguities enabled me to, you know, be a little fluid in my understanding. I'm not so dogmatic about an ideological view of what yoga is. For me, that's quite, I'm able to move freely that way. And that's because of my exposure to these world heavyweights in Sanskrit, I guess.
Yeah, I think I know what you mean. I mean, when you get the heavyweights in the room and all these powerful minds are trying to penetrate a Sanskrit manuscript together, all sitting around the room, all firing off at once, bringing different aspects of, you know, grammar and meter and all these databases really of Sanskrit knowledge systems behind them, and they come across things and there's uncertainty, right? There's questions, there's ambiguity. Let's crux that section. You know, we can, you know, you hit certain points where it's just a hypothesis, it's just a best guess, how to proceed, how to interpret, or if there's something missing in the text, how to fill that in. And I think there's always, for me, watching that happen too, there's a certain degree of humility. Like it's okay to admit that we don't know certain things. It doesn't mean that it can be whatever we want it to mean, but there's some degree of certainty in the unknowing that comes from just these true heavyweights who's not that they get stumped, but just showing that we simply do not have the data or the processes to kind of to figure this part out, right?
Absolutely, yes. And then one of the joys, I think, that comes from working with historical material, and particularly at this very primary source level, is that sometimes, you know, Jason and I often have this where we're working with you know, manuscripts that we've just discovered ourselves. You know, it wasn't catalogued correctly. It was in the back of the room, or it was in the bottom of the dustbin in a collection. It could even be a private collection. And all of a sudden, you have the opportunity to read words from deep in the past about either a practitioner of yoga or a type of practice of yoga. And for the first time, you know, this is the real joy for me, is the, I feel like I've been given a real gem, if you like, an absolute gem, a moment in which I, myself, and perhaps Jason are the only people in the world that have really looked at this for the first time. And perhaps you're the only one that has seen the insight for that moment. And it might bring to light, for example, you know, the really early work that Jason did when we were moving around pre-Oxford was this the idea of what is Hatha Yoga, right? That at the time, everyone thought they knew what it was. But here he was looking at Hatha Yoga, and it wasn't this ascetic practice, or it wasn't this complete technology of the body. Here we are, we have Hatha Yoga as, you know, it wasn't forceful physical practices, which is what it was understood to be at the time, but rather a mechanism of moving vitality, forcefully moving vitality in the body. And it was coming from Buddhist traditions. Like, this was a huge breakthrough. And you know, having Jason write that up and having preview to reading that material was really exciting. Same has happened, you know, of course, through the Hatha Yoga Project. Jason working closely with his colleagues, of course, Jim Mallinson, Mark Singleton, and so forth, you know, Daniela Bellavacqua. But, you know, from the textual side, you know, we spent maybe three of those 5 years in India trying to penetrate collections which aren't digitized. So it's not like you can just go to an online catalog and try to find these things. You know, we're going off sniffs of fragrant information that we receive from either colleagues or people we meet in India, and we're trying to pursue those and find, you know, a little piece of textual history that might change the way we think about the history of yoga. And that might be something like the Amaralga. You know, the Amaralga, when they first wrote up the proposal for the Hatha Yoga Project, they thought it was quite a late text, you know, post Hatha Buddhipika. But here we are after 5 years of research, and it's now the earliest Hatha text to teach a system of Hatha Yoga within this Hatha Raja combination. And it's now, you know, sourcing itself from this Buddhist text, the Amrita Siddhi, that Jim and Peter are translating. So for me, these...
I feel like we have to keep putting the earliest Hatha Yoga text in scare quotes, because when we read the articles of Birch and Mallinson over the last even just 5 years, we've seen announced or declared the earliest text like a few different times, you know what I mean? Like, whether it's the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, or now the Amaralga, or, you know, you could claim the Amrita Siddhi, although it's not using the term Hatha Yoga. But I guess it only highlights the point that you're making, is that there's real discoveries that are being made here that are fundamentally changing our understanding of the history of these traditions, right?
Oh, absolutely. So it's a really vibrant time to be in, you know, and vibrant time to be involved in the history of yoga, and also to have such learned colleagues, you know, that are pursuing this with all their academic rigor and passion. And then, like you say, if you're a person reading the secondary literature, all of a sudden you're seeing within the last, you know, 10 to 20 years, a real change in our understanding of what Hatha Yoga is. When was it written? Where did it come from?
Huge. I mean, yes. When you read something that was written 20 years ago, mm-hmm. it just doesn't hold up now.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. And look, the, you know, we have benefited as practitioners. We've benefited from the extraordinary funding that's been given to pursue this. So something like an ERC, an European Research Funding Grant that was given to the team at SOAS to pursue this, means that this type of work can get done. And it is a bit of a lottery ticket. You know, Jason and I have spent many years, you know, writing up these proposals. And, you know, it's like putting in a lottery ticket. You really don't know whether anything is going to come through. And the work is tedious and hard and expensive in terms of, you need to dedicate your life to it in order for it to manifest. And so without funding, this sort of research just couldn't happen. So we feel very lucky and privileged that, you know, there has been a flourishing, along with the pursuit of yoga in Western culture. There has been this, academic funding for this type of research.
Yeah, you mentioned these moments in the archive, you know, finding a little gem or a treasure or some text that maybe nobody's even looked at until that very moment. And it feels as if you guys are the only people in the world who might be privy to this little gem from yoga's past. I feel like what you guys have done with the Luminescent is to help share those little gems of knowledge with the world. And you've done such a beautiful job of curating this website of short articles and blog posts, and now online courses that you have been offering. So tell us a little bit about the Luminescent and how that came about. I'm also curious where the name the Luminescent comes from.
Mm-hmm. I guess that was my choice. I guess it comes from this idea of that experience in deep meditation. What are we pursuing? And you know, it has different names and different texts and so forth. But one might say it is a moment of luminescence or revelation or insight, if you like. And I guess my pursuit of starting something like the Luminescent was to push back. You know, this, I think we started to write up, it was at the end of 2011 or something like this. We really needed a way of communicating our research to a broader audience and sharing that. Mm. But I was also conscious of the commercial side of yoga and how it was actually becoming difficult for people to access high quality education on yoga, because the commercial push was asking people to pursue a career as a yoga teacher, and these yoga teaching programs were extremely expensive. They were like $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 people were asking. Mm-hmm. And I would say that they were quite rudimentary teachings. And this is not to dismiss people who have pursued becoming a yoga teacher through a 200-hour teacher training or something like that. But rather, I did see that all of a sudden, your ability to pay for education was limiting your access to the teachings of yoga. And so for me, that was one of the big drivers, was firstly to offer snippets of history, which I felt were extraordinary. You know, for us working with primary evidence, it was an opportunity to give people immediate access to that research in bite form, so not like academic articles, but rather translated into something that practitioners might be interested in. But at the same time, it was driven by my, and this is stemming from my engineering background, which is driven by communal access to open access education. That doesn't mean that you don't pay at some point for some part of your education, but rather that, you know, we really need to be demolishing some of the walls between academia and the history of yoga, and who has access to it and how can they access it, right? So we were at a time when you could produce a blog and write up something, and all of a sudden you have people that are interested in looking at this material. So that was great. And for me, there's sometimes moments which I wish I could share with people more freely. And now that we have things like, Instagram and so forth, it's a bit easier to do that. For example, right. one time in Tanjavur, we happened to be looking at, the very oldest manuscript of the Yoga Taravali. And then this is one of those texts that people actually chant every day in their Ashtanga yoga practice. So it's something that's really relevant to practitioners. And yet here we were looking at this manuscript that was in such poor condition that as we opened it had been somewhat preserved. It was held between Japanese tissue paper, and it was a really humid, hot day, 40 degrees, and there was a little fan above our head in this library in South India. And as we opened up the tissue paper, the manuscript was in such poor condition that it was dissolving in front of our eyes. The dust from the manuscript was lifting up into the air and moving into a fan above. And for us, this is a
terrible feeling.
It's an interesting feeling, because it's one of those moments of joy and sadness mixed together, because here we are seeing this extraordinary piece of history dissolving. But at the same time, there was some magic in seeing that piece of written material, but it was in too poor a condition to digitize, unfortunately. Whereas what we're seeing now is the digitization of manuscripts across India by various institutions, government, museums, private collections. And this is revolutionizing our you know, worldwide access to really important evidence.
Yeah, I had a similar experience with the Shiva Yoga Pradipika manuscript in Chennai at the Madras Government Oriental Institute.
Yes.
I'm sure you guys have been there.
Yes, if
you can recall that one. Mm-hmm. It's just a mess. And the manuscripts are so poorly organized and cataloged and taken care of. And there's like three or four different library marking systems, and it's really quite a mess. But they did manage to find some manuscripts for me, but one of them was in such poor condition that when I very carefully, you know, flipped over the folio, it really just disintegrated right in my hands. It was just this moment of...
It's a tragedy.
There was some joy in it.
Joy and tragedy at the same time. I find for myself.
My stomach just dropped. I was able to get the scan of one side of the folio, but not the complete other side.
But it does highlight the urgency.
Powerful reminder.
Yeah. The urgency of that
of
type
how fragile this history is and the transmission, you know, and actually the physicality of these knowledge systems.
Yes, absolutely. And the urgency of undertaking this type of work where no longer do we have scribes in India. The profession of rescribing manuscripts has died out. And so you're left with, manuscripts now that are upwards of 200 years old, and they're no longer being rescribed onto new, fresh palm leaf. And so the ones that we have need to be preserved. And I must say that a lot of libraries now in India are doing a fantastic job, and there has also been a national initiative to digitize many manuscripts. However, you do come across collections where they are in a real poor state of decay, and that's very, very tragic, and a loss that we can't, you know, that just simply can't be replaced. And then we also have this one wonderful aspect to personal collections, like private collections nowadays. Again, it's a double-edged sword, where sometimes manuscripts sit within a family collection, and they may not read manuscripts at all, so they may not have access to the material themselves, and they see it as a holy object within their personal collection. And when it does die, when the manuscript starts to dissolve, they would prefer to do a ritual of sending it down the river, because that's what you would do with that type of material. So they would rather see it decay than have it read or digitized. So that's one aspect. But then you also have opportunities like the Endangered Archive Project, which is a funding body run by the British Library, where they're giving money to personal collections, so giving money to people in India to digitise their personal collections. And that we've had quite a bit of success in getting people onto that while we're travelling around India. And that enables sometimes personal collections, which would have sat in bedrooms or in private altars inside family homes, it's giving an opportunity for that material to be digitized and made accessible to scholars.
No, that's great. Mm. And then you also have, institutions that are just simply not giving access to scholars, right, who are kind of choosing to keep private and to not have that kind of open access that you're talking about to reserve, whether that's to preserve or to block out. I know you guys recently had some interesting experiences in Mysore and at the Mysore Palace Library trying to access some of those manuscripts like the Sri Tattva Nidhi and trying to understand its relationship with the Hatha Vyasa Padati, which I want to talk about here shortly. If I'm not mistaken, didn't you guys actually you were granted an audience with the Maharani, with the Queen of Mysore, trying to find access? Can you tell us that story?
Yeah.
What you can tell us about that?
Yes. That's also one tinge with a little disappointment, Seth. But Like back in 2012, Jason and I, we were in Pune, and we discovered actually the manuscript, which is now known as the Hatha Vyasapadhiti, and this extraordinary 18th century text, which teaches 112 asanas, and many of them are moving asanas, and they're in grouped in sequences. And so at the time, we had come across this. Jason presented that research in Vienna in 2013, and it really did revolutionize the idea of what physical practices were, because I think about the same time, or just a little earlier, Mark Singleton's book had come out about the traditions of Mysore and the yoga body and so forth, and potentially suggesting that all of the, no doubt his thesis is correct in terms of the influence of physical culture in Mysore, and also the modernness of yoga, the physical yoga that came to the West. But also there wasn't an understanding of what did the physical practices look like in this early period, this pre-colonial period of India. And so we were really quite excited when we found the Hatha Vyasapadhiti. It was one text we sort of, again, it was found because it was catalogued under the wrong name, and we happened to come across it by accident. And so that was quite an extraordinary find in itself. But we also had hypothesized, this during, I think in his presentation in 2013, Jason, we had realized the connection between the Hatha Vyasapadhiti and the Sri Tattva Nidhi at that time, and we realized they were the same postures, and we knew that there was a connection there, but we weren't exactly sure whether a text of that of the Hatha Vyasapadhiti sat within the Mysore collection. We had hypothesized that there was, due to the direct relationship between the description of the postures, but that was a hypothesis, and we really wanted solid evidence to confirm that that was the case. And so part of the Hatha Yoga project was to go to Mysore, and we were lucky enough to spend quite a bit of time there, looking at the collection in the Oriental Research Institute, but also trying to get access to the palace archives. And that was, much more of a negotiation. It required us to meet with a lot of people, including some very important artists that were in the Mysore region, who enabled us to get access to the queen herself, the Maharani. She's a wonderful, well-educated lady who is well-versed in Sanskrit herself, as well as Kannada language, so she can read the manuscripts herself. And we were granted an audience with her on two occasions. We were very privileged to meet with her and discuss what we were hypothesizing is the idea that a manuscript of the Hatha Vyasapadhiti sits within her collection. And there's a lot of challenges with giving scholars like us access to a private collection, particularly a palace collection, which has not only importance to her family, but also importance to the region. And she was not able to confirm with us that the manuscript existed, but we knew it. We basically presented to her all the evidence we had, and told her we knew it did exist within her collection, but could we get
I mean,
access?
the scholar Norman Stjoman, in the 90s, right, he did get access and was able to photograph it, right? So we do know that at least at that time it existed, right?
Well, this was the extraordinary things. Norman Shorman didn't know he was looking at the Hatha Vyasapadhiti at all. So he didn't know he had that manuscript at all. That was a recent discovery. So it was actually after we had been to the World Sanskrit Conference in Canada that took place a couple of years ago, 2018 or something like that. So Norman had looked at the Sri Tattva Nidhi. And he had published on that in his very important book, the Traditions of the Mysore Palace, Yoga Traditions of the Mysore Palace. And we had arranged to see him in Canada because we really wanted to look at the original photographs of the Sri Tattva Nidhi. And so we went and arranged to go to his home, And we stayed with him for a couple of days. He was very kind enough to allow us to stay in his attic for a couple of days. And while we were there, we looked at his extraordinary collection of artworks, because he's a real collector of Mysore art. And after a couple of days staying with him, he agreed to show us some of the images of the Sri Thakmaniti that he took back in the 90s. And when we looked at his pictures, they, unfortunately, the digital pictures he had were corrupted. And it was, not possible for us to see them on the computer. And he said, well, don't panic. I'll go up into my attic and I'll go and see my original Kodak slides and I'll get them out for you. And this time it was about 8 p.m. at the night in the evening, and we were about to leave the next day from Canada to continue to drive to see the Ujasics, who live in Edmonton. And he gets out his collection of slides, Kodak slides, and we're looking, they were marked Sri Thakmaniti. And as we looked through those slides, about halfway through, the photographs change. And these were ones taken 10 years earlier, so in 1986, and then unpublished. So nobody's had access to them, and they were sitting in his archive, and nobody's actually ever even seen them before. And we were lucky enough, as we were looking at these images, which would have sat in Norman's attic, unfortunately, for the rest of his life probably, but as we looked at these slides, we were able to identify through the textual record that actually this was not the Sri Thakmaniti, and he didn't realise that he had taken photographs of another manuscript. And that manuscript just happens to be the one that we want to see and had hypothesised was in the archive. And so we were so excited. We stayed up all night. We did an all-nighter, and we took digital photos of these slides, and that's formed the basis of the paper that Jason and Mark Singleton have written and published in the Journal of Yoga Studies on the second manuscript, basically, of the Hatha Vyasapadati. So now we know for certain that the Hatha Vyasapadati sits within the Mysore Palace collection and also is the source for the Sri Thakmaniti. So this was a really exciting find, and one that we, still raises the hairs on my arm, because Jason and I was just couldn't believe we'd spent so many hours and hours and years of research trying to get access to a manuscript in Mysore, and here we are in Canada,
outside of Toronto.
Indeed, and here we are, and we found it, and it was serendipitous, and we absolutely feel that it was, one of these magic moments where we, it could have just sat there unknown for forever, really, never known. But we happened to, because also it wasn't just finding the old Kodak slides that sit within Norman's collection. It's actually knowing what you're looking at when you look at the slide itself. And we were able to identify that this is the manuscript. So it has enabled us to make some really important hypotheses about the relationship between the Hatha Vyasapadati, the Sri Thakmaniti, and Krishnamacharya's lineage of yoga, so that of Ashtanga Vinyasa in particular. Beyond the paper that Jason and Mark co-authored, I'm writing a paper myself more about the art side, so the illustrations within that manuscript itself and the relationship with Krishnamacharya. Yes,
because those are very interesting, and as you've found and are writing about, really important to our interpretation of some of the postures, right?
Indeed, yes. So I guess there was this before we knew about the Hatha Vyasapadati, or this manuscript which documents 112 asanas that are dynamic in movement, that seem to be in a fairly sequential order. It was, the history of Hatha Yoga was confined to about, 25 postures, and most of them were quite static, even if they were non-seated asanas such as Kukutasana or Mayurasana. They weren't techniques that involved bodily movement, or they weren't done for the purpose of strength and health. Whereas what we found in the Hatha Vyasapadati is exactly that, and that's informed the sort of physical postural practice that has made that transnational leap and has been popularized around the world by teachers such as, Patabi Joyce or BKS Iyengar and so forth. So really those foundational teachers who have popularized the physical techniques of Hatha Yoga. So for us, it was an extraordinary find. And the finding of that manuscript in Calgary meant that we went back to Mysore and we had another audience with the Maharani in Mysore.
And you told her of the discovery?
Indeed, and we showed her and we looked at it and so she knows it's there and we know exactly what it looks like. And perhaps in the future, these are long-term relationships with people who hold these collections. It may be in 10, 20 or 30 years time, we'll be able to look at the manuscript itself. But so when you can't be in a hurry with these things, that's what we've found with our pursuit of looking for important textual history, that's the slow side, right? The very, very slow and tedious work that takes many years before you get to something that's a published edited volume or a published translation and critical edition. There's years and years and years of work that go into it, and it's sometimes lost and it's not really able to be communicated through a printed book. But that's, I guess, one of the joys that we have is that we know the story. we know the story behind the words.
I want to ask you more about this Hatabhyasa Parati, and in particular the film that you're making surrounding it. But I want to ask you, what was the Maharani's just overall perspective on the work that you guys are doing? Sometimes you'll hear, especially vocally online on social media, there'll be some critiques or attacks against the Western scholar who's seen as kind of somehow appropriating this knowledge and coming in and taking manuscripts, or somehow this notion that one is selling or profiting or getting rich off of this Sanskrit knowledge, or fill in the blank. You know the conversations that I'm talking about. But in my experience, especially in India, interacting with people and talking about the work that we're doing, that's not typically the sentiment that I get in India. But I'm curious, with somebody of her stature, just overall, what was her? Was she interested in the work? Did she seem to care? What was her view?
Yes, well, as I mentioned, she's extremely well-educated and a learned practitioner of yoga herself. So she did reveal a little about her own personal practice and pursuit, but also she revealed to us as we looked through the manuscript material, which we presented to her, that she could read the material herself. And so one of the important contributions that she's made to her family's tradition is that she has started a heritage philanthropic I'm not sure, I can't think of the exact name of her organization, but it's one of preserving the heritage of Mysore, and this is in keeping with her past forefathers, if you like, who have all been interested in capturing the history of the unique history of Mysore in its traditions. And that's one of the things that was captured in the Sri Tathmanidhi itself. Wodeyar III, the Maharaj of the time in the 19th century, that's exactly what he was doing. He was trying to capture the history of Mysore and its unique cultural contributions, and she is one who is pursuing that herself, and she has a funding body who has very recently restored the Jagat Mohan Palace, which is a wonderful building which sits outside the Mysore Palace, and it has her personal collection as well as some of the collection of the state, artworks as well as manuscripts. And so I feel that for her in her position, holding on to that manuscripts and not revealing it to Western scholars was not one of not wanting scholars to pursue the study of yoga through primary sources, but rather she probably has intentions herself to either produce an edition at some point in time, or somehow it will fit into their personal collection, which she doesn't want to reveal to the public, right? So there's this ongoing debate within India, particularly amongst those who have inherited a royal collection, is there's a battle between state and private. And if she was to reveal something that's within her collection, then there is the threat that it will be taken into a public collection, and it may be very precious to her. So, you know, it's a very delicate line we face when looking at this material. And one thing that we've come to be very mindful of is respecting each person's relationship to this history, you know, because it's a very, very much a personal story. The manuscripts may be inherited through family lineage, and so they have value beyond the words that are written down. And so for us coming in as scholars who are interested in the content, you know, and preserving something that may dissolve, we also have to be mindful of the object's value, intrinsic value to the culture itself, and the value it might hold for someone's person, their own personal heritage.
So part of what you guys have been doing among all of these incredible endeavors, also including you being a founding member of the new Journal of Yoga Studies. We were just talking before we started recording. You've got a new issue of that coming out. You and Daniela Bevilacqua put together this incredible art exhibition, Embodied Liberation, that was part of the Hatha Yoga project. But one of the other things that our listeners will know that you've been working on, and I think that everyone's very excited about, is this film on the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati, and what you've called embodied philology. So tell us a little bit about embodied philology, and then the making of this film, which I know has involved traveling around the world, finding incredibly advanced practitioners in India and elsewhere, and trying to recreate the postural sequences.
Yes, I guess it fits a little into the approach that both Jason and I have towards the practice of yoga. A lot of the time, our teachings as well as our personal practice is informed by what we read in the past, and trying to understand what was actually being taught or recorded at that time. And so it was actually back in 2012 when we first discovered the Hatha Abhyasa Paddhati that Jason and I started to have these heated arguments really about the what was actually going on in some of these postures. Because if you could imagine, back in 2012, we didn't have the illustrations of the Sri Tathaviniti. We didn't understand the relationship then. And we were just left with a very obscure text which had very terse verses about the description of asanas. And we were attempting to reconstruct them, right? And that's what we do because we are practitioners at heart. And so, and this
you
meant...
You were saying, no, I think the elephant's pose, put the arm, the trunk of the elephant here. And Jason would say, no, the grammar clearly says put the trunk here.
That yes, kind of thing. Indeed, yes. And it was a lot of, sitting with the Sanskrit and the terseness of the Sanskrit, trying to understand, did the description in one verse connect with the verse in the next verse? You know, and it's a lot of grammar as well as philology that goes into reconstructing the verse itself and then actually then interpreting that verse. And try not to bring your contemporary view into that verse. And that's one thing that I guess the reconstruction was part of that. So before we pursued creating the film, which we showed two parts of that in the Embodied Liberation exhibition in the Brunei Gallery, before that, Jason and I had reconstructed a lot of these asanas and were teaching it to groups of people. Generally speaking, they were yoga teachers, and we were presenting them with the terseness of the verse and asking them to interpret it. And it was through that practice that we realized that really we really wanted to document this and bring it to life in the form of the film. When part of the Hatha Yoga project was funded, Jim and Mark also thought it was kind of a really good idea. And, Mark had access to people. We're not from the UK, so we're not so familiar with the people there, but Mark had access to the extraordinary practitioners of Ashtanga Vinyasa Yoga in London, such as Ruth Westerby, Philippa Usher, Agi, and so forth. And these practitioners are at the top of their game, more than 20, 25 years of physical practices. And we knew the limitations of even contemporary practitioners, particularly female practitioners, to do some of these extraordinary strength-based postures. And even when working with the practitioners in London, we realized that, that the techniques documented in this extraordinary 18th century text are well beyond the capacity of most people. And so unless you're practicing this sequence, even those who had been pursuing the physical postures of Ashtanga Vinyasa, these postures were beyond their capacity. In fact, I think of the 108, we had about 28 or so that we couldn't reconstruct. And so when Jason and I...
Oh, I've been telling that story wrong. I thought it was of the 112, right?
Mm. I said 108, didn't I? But
well, it's very auspicious. I thought perhaps there was only one that eluded.
One has eluded us in terms of our ability to reconstruct it completely. But in terms of the practitioners that we were working with, we worked with a lot of people from different cultures. We'd actually reconstructed it in Singapore, in Japan, and with senior teachers in the British Wheel of Yoga. We taught around the UK, in Wales, in Scotland, and so forth. So we'd had a lot of input from a lot of different practitioners, not just those from Ashtanga Vinyasa. And that was important for us because it meant that we could disentangle some of the influences that modern contemporary practitioners bring to the interpretation of these asanas. And we're much more versed, I guess, in doing that, mainly because it's been our work for such a long time. We can try and sort of separate our personal view, what's informed, and try and place ourselves directly in the history. So place ourselves in that period of time. What could they have been thinking when they are writing something like this? And so when reconstructing, I think there was about 20 or so we couldn't do with the practitioners in London. So next time when Jason and I went to India, I basically looked throughout India for practitioners who I thought could potentially do some of these extraordinary asanas. And that's when I came across a school in Khed in Maharashtra, which is really quite, auspicious or serendipitous in that it's probably very close to where the manuscript of the Hatha Vyasa Padati was authored and written, not too far, about an hour's drive. And we were in contact with this particular school in Khed where they do practice, 7 days a week, 5 hours a day, extraordinary asanas. And we worked with practitioners from that school, and we were able to reconstruct the final 20 or so, bar one. So it's with the practitioners, both in London and in Khed, that we've reconstructed all 111, with the elusive 112 posture. Yeah,
and that school in Khed, I remember reading about it because you guys did a fundraiser to help get some more yoga mats and props to help support the school. It's young children, right, who are training. Is it all boys? Is it boys and girls?
It's boys and girls, and you know, they're really helped by their extraordinary teacher, Mangesh. And yes, you were one of our helpful fundraisers, Seth, so we appreciate that. And what we were really struck by was the dedication, not only of the teacher, but also the students themselves to their own practice. You know, they would come after school and start about 3:30 in the afternoon. They'd lie down. They didn't have yoga mats. They just had this polystyrene boards, you know, that you would normally see that are used to encase computers or TV screens or something like that. And that's what they had as their yoga mats. And these were young children from about the age of 5 right through to about 18. So when they finished high school, and then if you graduated from that program, some of them would become a teacher in yoga, if you like, within the school. And their main pursuit of the practice was encouraged by not only their teachers, but also their family members, because if they did very well in the program, they could potentially represent the school at the national championships. And therefore, you know, you could potentially win a medal or acknowledgement of your efforts in yoga.
Right. So they're training for yoga competitions. Yoga as sport.
For the national championships, that's right. And one of the pursuits of that is that if you succeed in achieving a gold medal or some sort of acknowledgement of your skill in practice, you know, it basically guarantees you a government job at some point in time. Well, it's looked very favorably upon if you have dedicated yourself at so much so as to win some competition of yoga.
Do you think in your conversations with the teacher and those students there, do you think they view yoga as a soteriological practice that is there, you know, with an aim of samadhi, let's say, or do you think it's more purely yoga as a sport, as a physical exercise or endeavor, or can it be a bit of both?
Well, the interesting thing, I don't think the soteriological aims of yoga are lost on the culture, right? So they're studying yoga within Indian culture, and I think it's always understood that the pursuit for soteriological aims is one that people could pursue in later life. But what you're seeing at play when you look at young children being taught yoga and young children being pursuing, I guess, yoga competitions, is that they're working within a school curriculum. So it was very, we did speak with the teacher about it, and there are some very strict rules about what is taught to them under this sports curriculum, what is in and what is out, for example. You know, they're not allowed to practice things like Uddiyana Bandha or Nali, for example. That's not in the curriculum, and it's seen as something that you pursue later in life. But what they're doing is giving them the foundations of a physical practice. And the emphasis, I guess, is on the postural practice. But these are young, supple bodies and young, supple minds. And perhaps, you know, part of sitting quietly at the end of practice is certainly there. But I think within a school curriculum, there are some very specific rules that are around what can be taught and what can't. And of course, some of these school curriculums are within a secular teaching environment. So that also means you probably can't do some sort of devotional practice. You know, so that's, you know, what you're seeing at play in India, in contemporary India school life, is a contemporary form of yoga, you know, where it is pursued within a sports curriculum. And that doesn't mean that if they pursue yoga later in life, for example, if they take on board the practice of yoga to become a certified yoga teacher within India, you know, the curriculum for that certainly involves understanding the history and soteriological aims of yoga beyond that of the asanas. So it's kind of like the groundwork, I guess, that happens within these types of schools that are pursuing yoga as a sports pursuit.
Mm, yeah. It's really fascinating, especially when, you know, we contrast it with some of the critiques of yoga in the West as being, you know, purely physical and having stripped away the spiritual, you know, or religious aspects. I sometimes feel like that fails to take seriously or into account a lot of the yoga actually that's happening, especially in urban areas in India today. But it's complex. There's a lot of layers to it, and there's different cultural things that are going on, I think, you know, in India than say in Singapore or Sydney or California. Moving us along here, and for the sake of time, because we're kind of starting to wind down here, and I want to respect your time here today, that of our listeners, of course. So just to wrap up about the film, I got to see a little sneak preview of it that you showed at that World Sanskrit Conference in Canada, which was in Vancouver, not Toronto. I was remembering that incorrectly earlier. And the film just looks beautiful. It's really well done. When can listeners expect to see the film? When will it be done?
Oh, that's the question I'm continually asked. We had
because you've been teasing us. You've been teasing us with the film for a while now.
We have, and we did. Because you mentioned briefly the exhibition, Embodied Liberation, that we put on, and that was an unexpected output, I guess. I was worked very closely with Daniela Bellavacqua of the Hatha Yoga Project to pull that together in 6 months. We had been given the opportunity to use a gallery within the Brunei Gallery, a particular room, and it was, you know, it was a lot of work to pull that together quite quickly, and it meant that I focused mainly on that for some time, and we put two of the sequences as a feature of the exhibition, and we have another two sequences which we had intended to show at another exhibition that I was putting on for the IOO project called Longevity. Unfortunately, that was due to take place in July last year or something like that. I can't remember. Oh, no, it must have been this year. Yeah, we're in 2021, aren't we? So it was in 2020. Mm. However, that got postponed due to COVID, and it's really been a bit of a flux. And we had that's been rescheduled for July 2021. And so we're sort of holding off to just see what happens. It's looking more and more likely that it's not going to happen because of the circumstances of COVID. So we'll have to see,
we were hoping to debut the film
indeed,
at that longevity.
Yeah, we were debuting another two sequences. But so look out for it, you know, towards the mid to late this year. That's where it is at the moment. It's really close, but I've had to divert my attention to other things as we finalised our lives, I guess, in the UK, and also the onset of COVID has postponed a couple of things that we had hoped to deliver towards the end of last year.
Absolutely. They're completely understandable, and we've got a lot on our plates, and I know everybody will be grateful for when it does come out. And I think you guys will, in spirit of everything you've been saying, it'll be an open access film, something that people can watch online.
Yes, that's right. So we had, raised a little bit of money to support some of the camera work and so forth that we had to do in London and in India, and that a little bit of funding has enabled us to ensure that we can kind of make it an open access film. It's also written as part of the Hatha Yoga Project's outputs. We're hoping to provide that quite openly to people to enjoy.
Well, Jackie, we're
almost out of time.
We're really excited to have you come on to Yogic Studies with Jason Birch to offer this new online course, Raja Yoga: History, Theory, and Practice. We've talked quite a bit about Hatha Yoga and the history of asana today, something that doesn't get talked about often as much or enough, or frankly, that I think we know even less about actually, is this rich tradition of Raja Yoga, which, despite what most people think when they hear that term, does not necessarily mean the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali or even Ashtanga Yoga. So we're really excited for this course and this deep dive. You know, Jason will be covering history and theory in his lecture series, but one of the unique things about this course and your contributions will be two practice sessions, an embodied philology, if you will. So tell us a little bit about what students can expect in the course overall, and then a little bit a preview of these practice sessions, which I'm really excited to have you offer.
Well, thank you again, Seth, for the opportunity. And really, you know, one of the extraordinary things when we look at this idea of what is Raja Yoga is that it is the goal of Hatha Yoga. So all those people that are out there pursuing the physical techniques of Hatha Yoga, we know from the history that they were never separate, right? So the earliest text, the Yamaralga, that teaches a framework of Hatha Yoga, it's always subordinate to this idea of a Raja Yoga, this yoga which is deep absorption, in which one sits still with no mind or no breath, for example, and has this deep realization or liberation in life. And so for us, it's, I guess, this course is really trying to broaden people's understanding of what they are doing. What are the goals? What are the goals of some of the techniques that they might be pursuing in terms of physical techniques? So even the earliest works of Hatha Yoga all aim towards Raja Yoga. And as we move through history, the goal never changes, if you like, in terms of Raja Yoga is always the goal of all of these different variations as Hatha Yoga evolves from being a single technique that people can pursue right through to the complex systems of Hatha Yoga we find in contemporary life, where you're having asanas, bandhas, mudras, breathing techniques and so forth. All of these aim towards this same goal of Raja Yoga. So what is that? And we'll be looking at that closely. And we'll be, within the practical sessions, we'll be attempting some of these techniques. So you mentioned a couple of times this idea of embodied philology. It's one of these words that we catchphrases that we like to use, in which we take something from the past. So it's not necessarily a living teaching. It's a teaching that exists within a textual context. We'll look at that teaching, and then we'll, in some ways, attempt it. You know, we'll be bringing it to life. And so we'll be looking at some of these techniques of Raja Yoga, particularly that of the 18th century Garanda Samhita, which is a text that happens to have six ways to samadhi. So samadhi wasn't just this one pursuit. You could achieve samadhi, or this deep state of absorption, through different techniques. And not all of those are simply seated in meditation. Some of them are breathing exercises. So we'll be looking at some of the techniques that lead to this liberative state of deep absorption, and how can we get there? And so that will be part of the interactive sessions that we'll do in this particular course.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's a very interesting section of the Garanda Samhita, this sort of sixfold Raja Yoga. Folks can take a look at the text if they want to have a little peek inside. When I was reviewing it, I was actually surprised to see bhakti yoga as one of the six means of Raja Yoga towards samadhi, which we don't always see in the Hatha Yoga text, but is something I'm really looking at in my work on Shiva Yoga.
Yes.
So that all just sounds fantastic, and what a wonderful opportunity to get to dive into the world of Raja Yoga with yourself and Jason. So we invite everybody who's interested to come aboard. The course runs live from February 8th through March 5th. Sorry, I had to look at the calendar there. It'll run live. Feel free to join us. But as with all of our courses, it'll also be recorded and you can partake in it with your self-study at a later date if the timing doesn't work for you. Well, Jackie, I think we've hit our time limit. We probably exceeded it. Thank you so much, really, for taking the time and walking us through your story and all of this incredible work that you've been doing and are really right at the forefront of. Any final words or anything that we missed that you want to touch on today?
No, that was all. Thank you so much, Seth. And it's good to know, like looking and just pulling up in front of me, you know, people think about the idea of Raja Yoga and it's fairly alien. But if we even look at a text that people might be familiar with, like the 15th century Hatha Pradipika, you find in verse 2.76, something like, without Hatha Yoga, Raja Yoga is not accomplished. And without Raja Yoga, nor is Hatha. Therefore, the yogin should practice both until the final stage of yoga is attained. So I hope we can finish there with our discussion and also with our study of the practice and the deep connection between Hatha Yoga and this idea of Raja Yoga.
Beautiful. Perfect way to end it. Invite those Hatha Yogis to become Raja Yogis. Jackie, where can folks find you online? And is there anything else you wanted to promote? Anything coming up?
Of course, theluminescent.org is our website where we try to promote young scholars like yourself as well, who are up and coming and doing some fantastic research. So you can also read blog posts there by people, some of our courses available there. But also, you know, you mentioned a little earlier the Journal of Yoga Studies. We founded that with our co-members, of course, Elizabeth DeMarcellis, Jason Birch, and Suzanne Newcomb and Matthew Clark. And we have a new volume coming out very soon. So look out for that. It's got an extraordinary article coming out on a very, very interesting text on yoga and yoga chikitsa, so yoga as therapy. So look for that in the coming month.
Very exciting. All right. Well, thanks again, Jackie. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Please take care. And we'll talk again soon, okay? Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or sharing this episode with someone else. Thanks so much, everyone. Until next time, please take care.